two ladies' trios sing today. So we had the ladies' trio sing this morning, and then these college ladies sang. Linda, you need to get on your friends, though. None of them had their smartphones out taping you, recording you while you were singing. But I noticed quite a few of those going on while these ladies were singing. But I appreciate the good job both trios did singing today, singing Christmas songs, and I appreciate the hard work that went into that. 2 Samuel chapter 11 begins a new section of 2 Samuel. All right, we're coming off of chapter 10 and the kindness that David shows, we're in chapter 10, coming off chapter 9 and the kindness that David shows to Mephibosheth. One thing I didn't mention, and probably should have last week, was that this kindness to Mephibosheth was not just David being kind, but it was his showing covenant fidelity to Jonathan. If you remember, he and Jonathan had made an agreement that when David came to the throne, he would remember Jonathan's family. And this Hebrew word for kindness in chapter 9 is the idea of being kind in the sense of remembering a covenant. Covenant fidelity, covenant loyalty, loyalty to someone. So we see David's kindness, not just doing good to his enemies, but also showing this covenant loyalty to Mephibosheth and the household of Jonathan and Saul. And then we see in chapter 10 the reverse of this. Have you ever been in a situation where someone mistreated you after you'd been kind to them? I think we've all had those kinds of situations where, you know, someone, we've tried to be kind to them and then they weren't kind back to us. One of the situations that always comes to my mind is several years ago we had men's prayer breakfast and we had eggs and bacon and biscuits and gravy, and this man came by and we were just about to bow our heads to pray for men's prayer breakfast, and this guy said, "Hey, excuse me, somebody going to help me over here?" I thought, okay, we'll see what we can do. Pastor Fernette, our assistant pastor at the time, went over there to talk to the man. And we all went to prayer, and this man said to Pastor Fernette, "I'm hungry, I haven't eaten in a few days, what are you going to do about it?" And Pastor Fernette said, "Well, let me see what I can do." So he went out, and there was still some biscuits and gravy left, there was some cantaloupe, but the eggs and bacon were gone. If you serve men eggs and bacon and you tell them they can have seconds, it will be gone. That's the way it works generally, especially the bacon, okay? The bacon never lasts, it's always gone. And so Pastor Fernette puts three biscuits on a plate, puts some cantaloupe on a plate, and the man looks at him and says, "What's this?" He said, "Cantaloupe." He said, "I don't eat that stuff." Okay, so put the cantaloupe back on the serving dish, and he put another biscuit on there. Guy bites into a biscuit, and he's like, "Where's my eggs and bacon?" And Pastor Fernette said, "Well, we finished the breakfast already. The bacon's gone." And this guy's talking, and biscuit crumbs are flying while he's talking, you know. And he said, "Well, you call yourselves Christians, and you won't share your bacon with me?" If we'd had extra bacon, we'd have given him some bacon. But it was gone. I don't have the ability to just create bacon. So it just doesn't work that way. And you call yourselves Christians and you won't share your bacon with me? And Pastor Fernette said, "We would have given you some bacon, but it's gone." And the guy starts into, "You Christians always mistreat people." Now he's saying this while he's chewing our biscuit. Right? Now think about this. You were hungry. Somebody gave you four biscuits. Baked fresh that morning. And you're complaining that they won't give you something else. All right, that's being completely ungrateful. First of all, he came in with an expectation that he was going to get something. And then being completely ungrateful. And, you know, there were other men in our church that were like, "Really? What'd you put up with that for? I'd have just trespassed him." You know, he starts cursing at me. And he started using colorful language and things like that. And, you know, it was a problem. Now, you know, we like to minister to people if we can. Somebody's hungry, I'm glad to give them some food if we have it. Glad to see them be fed and helped. But, you know, if I feed you, don't curse me while you're chewing my food. All right? And what we see here in chapter 10 is the opposite of this covenant faithfulness. Chapter 10 actually starts the new section in 2 Samuel, and it begins, there's a theme word here that I'm going to point out as we go through chapter 10. And what we find is David's kindness to this nation is actually mistreated. "And it came to pass after this that the king of the children of Ammon died, and Hanun his son reigned in his stead." Now the Ammonites had been historic opponents to Israel, but the king of the Ammonites, Nahash, we find out here, actually had made an alliance, a treaty with David. There was kindness between them. "Then said David, I will show kindness unto Hanun the son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness unto me." Now notice this phrase, "show kindness." In other words, I'll keep my treaty with them. I'll keep my covenant loyalty with them, just as his father did with me. In other words, if we made a treaty and his father kept it, so I'm going to keep it with the son too. And David sent to comfort him by the hand of his servants for his father. And David's servants came into the land of the children of Ammon. So he sends a delegation. He says, probably that most likely in that day there would have been gifts that they would have brought. They would have brought their condolences from the king as well as gifts. And would have said, you know, we're so sorry to hear about the passing of your father. We hope that our countries can have as good of a relationship now with you as the king as we had when your father was the king. However, there's some suspicious people in the court. And the princes of the children of Ammon said unto Hanun their lord, thinkest thou that David dost honor thy father, that he hath sent comforters unto thee? Hath not David rather sent his servants unto thee to search the city and to spy it out and to overthrow it? So here are these men, and they're suspicious. They're going, we know David. Look how he's put the Philistines down, all of Israel's historical enemies he's been dealing with. We're next. These guys didn't come here to send a condolence for your father's passing. They're spies. They're here to come spy out the land and tell you and tell their king, David, what's going on so that he can attack with the best way possible. Now notice, David has kept his covenants up to this point. Kept his covenant with the household of Jonathan. There's no reason to expect he won't keep his covenant with Nahash and his family. Here, Hanun. But this young man listens to the suspicious counselors. Wherefore, Hanun took David's servants and shaved off one half of their beards and cut off their garments in the middle, even to their buttocks, and sent them away. So this is intended not to be an abuse, but a humiliation. In other words, he doesn't beat them, he doesn't kill them, but what he does is he says, basically, you know, two things we have to understand culturally here, all right? Men in that culture wore beards. It was normal. It was a sign of manhood, all right? And so they wore beards as a sign of manhood and wisdom. In other words, being able to grow a beard means you're an adult male and that you have lived life a little bit and you have some wisdom. All right. Now, I realize beards are a cultural thing. From one time to the next, you know, you can look through pictures in history and you can see, you know, you look at our paintings of our founding fathers and you don't see George Washington with a beard, do you? But yet you get to the Civil War and you see everybody's got a beard. Right? So you get to another period in American history and everybody seems to have a beard in all the some kind of facial hair in all of the pictures that get to the photographic era. And then you get, you know, even among Christians. Have you ever seen paintings or photographs of, you know, Christian leaders from the 1800s? You get into the mid-1800s, Charles Spurgeon, for example, has this big beard. All right? So it's cultural. And then you get into the early 20th century and the beard shapes change. You get to mid-20th century and beards are gone. All right, you see pictures of men during World War II, and just almost nobody has a beard. Just almost no one has facial hair, and it's looked at differently. My grandfather, who's a World War II veteran, said to me one time, he said, don't worry about growing a beard. He said, men who grow beards are, now this was his perspective, I'm not saying this is true, I'm not preaching this, don't misunderstand that. But what he's saying is men who grow beards are growing beards because they're insecure about their masculinity, and they have to show outwardly that they're a man. Whereas on the other hand, I've also got a friend who said, you know, if you don't grow a beard, you look like all the other women. That's what he told me. And the fact is that the Bible doesn't say have a beard or don't have a beard. It just simply doesn't say that. And I do realize some of you grew up in the 60s and an era when people started to wear beards as a sign of rebellion. I mean, the hippie movement, much of that was, hey, we're going to burn down society and we're going to remake America as a godless socialist nation. And you know, they're out, protesting and getting involved in drugs and illicit behaviors and immorality, and they're growing beards because they're trying to show they're against the establishment and against the norms of society and all these kinds of things. But I think we've gotten to a day now where, you know, facial hair is something some people have, some people don't. And it's, you know, if you don't, you don't. If you do, you do. We're not really at the place where everybody's like, oh, you know, if you say, oh, he's a hippie, look at that beard, people are going to go, you know, all of our millennials are going to go, what's a hippie? Not that they don't know. I'm not saying they're ignorant. They're just like, what is that? They weren't alive during that period. They don't know what that is. It doesn't have, and even if you said, oh, it was this group of people that protested, they're like, yeah, way back when? You know, it'd be like, I remember my grandparents saying, guy looks like a beatnik. And I said, Mom, what's a beatnik? Yeah, I didn't know what a beatnik was. I knew what a hippie was. I didn't know what a beatnik was. Yeah, these different eras where, you know, different styles of facial hair. And obviously, you know, there could be certain styles of facial hair that would be inherently associated with something. I would not suggest that you grow a very narrow mustache that just basically is as wide as your nose. You look like Adolf Hitler. right? And that's still sort of associated. You just generally don't see people walking around with Hitler mustaches. Even though in the 30s it might have been a popular thing in Germany, today people would say, why do you look like Hitler? Right? Because you just can't get away from that association. So there's a certain time when you go, that has an association. A lot of Christian men would have said in the 70s, I'm not growing a beard because they're going to think I'm a hippie. I don't want people to think I'm into drugs and the counterculture. And they wouldn't have grown a beard. But today, you know, it's acceptable. Lots of men grow beards. Some men look good with them. Some look scraggly with them. And some of us, our wives don't like them. So it just really depends on what's going on. But in their culture, a man always had a beard. All right, it was a sign of his masculinity and of his wisdom. And so here are these wise male counselors. I mean, these are men of the court. These beards, and they have these long beards to show their wisdom. Look, I've had some time to grow my beard. Okay? And so what they do is they shave off half their beard. So one half of their face is clean shaven now. What is that doing? It's humiliating. Nobody's going to keep half a beard. See, what that does is it forces you to either shave off the other half or wait around somewhere in private till the rest of your beard grows back and catches up with what you know, lost. So they forcibly shave their beards off, and then this other part about cutting off their garments, this would be embarrassing in nearly any culture, and so you can see, you know, they make you walk half naked home. Obviously, that's a little easier to remedy. You can find clothing faster than your beard will grow. Now what we see here is verse 5. When they told it unto David, he sent to meet them because the men were greatly ashamed. In other words, don't come back into Jerusalem this way. Not because David's ashamed of them, but he knows they're ashamed. They got half a beard. They're not fully dressed. Basically, David's saying, I can imagine he's probably saying, take them some clothing. Keep in mind, too, this is a major hit. A change of clothing took about a year's wages to purchase. It took a long time to produce. Now, these were probably wealthy men. They were men of the court. They probably had some wealth, and they probably had a change of clothing. But still, imagine if, let's say the median income in Winter Garden is $40,000 or something like that. Imagine if men, in order to buy a suit, you know, you're going to go to a nice function. You'd be wearing a suit if you're going to go represent the king somewhere. In order to buy a suit, it cost you $40,000. And then somebody cut your suit up. That's a financial hit as well as a embarrassment. All right? And so probably David sent them new clothes, and he said, you stay at Jericho. Jericho, they would have crossed. Ammon's on the other side of the Jordan River. They would have crossed the Jordan River. That's the first city you get to crossing the Jordan. He says, basically, stay there. You're in the first town in Israel, and you stay there. We'll put you up. We'll make sure, give you some time for your beards to grow back before you come back to court life so you don't have to feel humiliated. All right? Don't misunderstand this, though. This is an act of war. This is an act of war. It used to be there were certain things that were accepted among certain cultures as an act of war. We still have that today. The United States, we tend to try to show a lot of restraint because we can defeat most nations in a war. It might sometimes be costly for us, but there's not a lot of question about whether we could defeat somebody in a war. Many of our aircraft carriers have a larger air force aboard the aircraft carrier than nations have in their entire air force. Most of the air forces of the world are not as big as one carrier full of planes. And we have, what, 12 carriers or something in the United States now? So we have 12 times the average Air Force in just naval air power. That's not the United States Air Force. So we've got this massive military, and so we're often like, yeah, they insulted us. They're burning our flag in the streets. But there was a day when nations were a little more parity, and you burned our flag in the streets. You humiliate our ambassadors. You drag our ambassador through the streets of Libya and Benghazi, and we would have gone to war with you. All right, that would have happened. I'm not saying we should have done that. I'm just saying that if the day was that was enough of an insult that you've declared war on us. You've attacked us. That's an attack. To attack an ambassador is an attack on the United States. And back then, to attack these ambassadors was an attack on David. These were David's representatives. Remember this. These aren't just some guys from Israel. These are David's representatives. They've been attacked because this is the closest they can come to attacking David at that point. In other words, they're saying, we know what you're up to, David. We're going to send these guys back. We're not afraid of you. So when they were told it to David, he sent to meet them. Tarry there at Jericho until your beards be grown and then return. And when the children of Ammon saw that they stank before David, in other words, David's not very happy with this. Not only because they've mistreated these representatives of David, but because they've now insulted Israel. The children of Ammon sent and hired the Syrians. They go, uh-oh, the Israelites are going to probably go to war with us. David's been winning wars. We better get some help. So they hire the Syrians. Now, Syria's up in that same region, okay? It's up on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. They're on the other side of the Jordan River, so it's Syria's northeast from Israel, and the Ammonites are east from Israel. So basically, they're asking their neighbors, hey, we need some help here. They sent and hired the Syrians of Beth-Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 footmen. And of King Maacah, 1,000 men, and Ishtob, 12,000 men. So they're hiring mercenaries. They're like, hey, you know, we need to hire some of your armies because we're going to go to battle here. And when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the host of the mighty men. So now David says, well, we better raise our army because we got a war on us. Now, interestingly, David meant no war by this at all, right? Now, I want you to look, and we have to point out a key word here. Verse 2, and David said, I will show kindness unto Hanun, the son of Ahash, as his father showed kindness unto me. And David sent to comfort him. All right? And then what do we see here? Do you think he honors thy father? Verse 3, that he hath sent comforters unto thee? Now, this is a common word, but it occurs awfully frequently in the next three chapters. So frequently that it's a theme word. It's not just a common word. Hath not David rather sent his servants unto thee to search out the city? All right? And he shaves off the beards, etc. And when they told it to David, he sent to meet them. All right? Verse 6. And when the children of Ammon saw that they stank before David, the children of Ammon sent and hired the Syrians. All right? And when David heard of it, he sent Joab. You see this word sent. Why? What is it showing? It's showing the exercise of power. It's showing the exercise of political power here. When you can say, I'm going to send an embassy to a country, that's political power. When you send and hire mercenaries, that's political power. When you send to your ambassadors on their way back, that's political power. What we're seeing here is David exercising political power and the Ammonites exercising political power. And so the question is that we've been asking through 1 Samuel and into 2 Samuel is, who's worthy to be the king of Israel? And we've seen David is the answer. I mean, he's behaved in ways that are so different than the pagan kings around him that David keeps coming as the answer. And here is the first time that we see David overtly acting with political power. I mean, this is the first time the passage starts saying, David did this. Here's what David did as king. Yes, we have accounts of his winning battles, but here we see over and over and over political and military exercises going on, if you would. We get more of the details than we get in some of the other passages. And so the question is, how is David going to exercise this power? This is foundational. Keep this in mind when we get to the next passage, because in chapter 11, we're going to find this word sent a lot too. And David exercises his power differently in chapter 11 than he does in chapter 10. All right? We'll take note of that. But here, what we find is this is what we would consider appropriate use of political power. You send an embassy to console your neighbor who's been your ally, and then they repay you by an act of war. And then they raise an army, so you have to send and raise your army to defend yourself. This is everything we would expect the king of Israel to do. All right, he's keeping his covenants. David's doing nothing wrong here. When Joab saw that the front of the battle was against him, verse 8, and the children of Ammon came out and put the battle in array at the entering of the gate, and the Syrians of Zobah and of Rehob and Ishtob and Maacah were by themselves in the field. So we see the Ammonites and then the Syrians are together. So what they've done here is they've now outmaneuvered Israel. They've created two battle fronts. So Israel's got to fight them on two fronts, which is a more difficult situation. When Joab saw that the front of the battle was against him, before and behind, he chose of all the choice men of Israel and put them in array against the Syrians. So he takes the best soldiers, this is the smaller group, and he puts them in against the mercenaries. In other words, these are made up of the men that are described to us later as David's mighty men. All right? These are the men who are known for their renown in battle. These are men who probably were professional soldiers, the Joabs and these kinds of men who had armor and swords. And this is what they lived to do. This is what they trained every day to do, to be a professional soldier. Okay? And there's a group of these men, and they're going to go to battle against the Syrians. Now, also, you have the larger force. When you call up the army of Israel, let's face it, many of them are farmers and others, and they bring whatever weapon they have. I mean, a lot of times Hollywood loves to do this. We have this romanticized idea of all this, Iron Age armor and shields and stuff. And there were definitely men arrayed that way, but you also had a bunch of farmers with said, the best thing I got is an axe here or a pitchfork or something and no armor. And you're just going to go out to battle and just it's going to be a melee battle with crazy nasty. These would be nasty battles. War's always bad, but this is especially bloody. All right, especially up close. You know, we live in a day and today where there's times that we have soldiers, airmen, sailors, Marines that kill people and don't even see the person they killed. We have aircraft that can shoot down enemy aircraft without even seeing it. We have missiles that can track somebody from hundreds of miles away and shoot them down, launch a missile, fire and forget, and shoot the enemy aircraft down and never even see that other plane. And drop a smart bomb through the window of a building and not even really know who's in there. Just know you blew the building up. You didn't even see the person you killed. In that day, you didn't kill people without seeing them. They were up close and personal. It was nastiness. And so that's what's going on. This battle is set. And Joab saw the front of the battle was against him. And verse 10, and the rest of the people he delivered into the hand of Abishai, his brother, that he might put them in array against the children of Ammon. So the bigger group of untrained soldiers, they go against the Ammonites. And he said, if the Syrians be too strong for me, then thou shalt help me. In other words, if I'm having trouble, I'm going to send you a messenger, and I need you to send me some help. But if the children of Ammon be too strong for thee, then I will come and help thee. In other words, this is our best battle plan with two fronts going on. We'll aid each other if we need it. Be of good courage, and let us play the men for our people. All right? This is a King Jamesism. It has the idea of play the man, has the idea of be a man about it. Okay? In our politically correct culture, I know that's an offensive thing to say. Men still say it to each other, though. All right? Men will still look at each other and say, be a man. What they mean by that is don't behave like a child, don't behave like a woman, and I'm glad women are women. Okay? But sometimes men, we have to be men. And that's a good thing. God made men to be men. We live in a society that wants men to be boys, or turns men into boys, or keeps them as boys, or wants men to be hairy women. Okay? Just women with more body hair. And that's not what God intended. All right? That's not what God intended. Is this idea of being courageous, being a man. If somebody comes into this room and starts threatening, if some of the women scream, we're going to be fine with that. If one of you men goes, ah, and screams, we're going to be like, why are you screaming? Right? Because we're going to be a man about this. You might be afraid, but don't be screaming like a woman. We're just going to laugh at that. And I know, I'm saying this, and it seems like such common sense, but we live in a day when my saying this, if this were published, like, broadly, if I tweeted this out, I'd get, attacked. You sexist jerk. Sorry, no, that's not how God made the creation. He made men and women, and he did make men to protect women. Okay? It is the job of men to protect women. Now think about this. When you take that away, when you say men no longer have to protect women, you get Harvey Weinstein. Because men aren't going to stop being attracted to women, so you just turn them into predators. So there was a day and age when men were taught, you protect women. And yes, you had some predators, but there were enough other men that stood up to the predators that said, sorry, not in my house, that's not going to happen. And they took care of it, whether it was through the legal system or whatever. And it was taken care of. Men were men. I mean, you go back, it's over 100 years ago now, but Titanic. I mean, I don't know if you think about how remarkable of a time it was that, was that 1912, something like that, the Titanic sinking. One side of the boat, they've been told women and children first. So that's interpreted on one side of the ship as fill the lifeboats with all the women and children, and if there's space, put men on it. On the other side, where second class was, that was interpreted by the crew as put the women and children in the lifeboats and launch them and leave the men on the deck. Almost all the men in second class died because of the way they loaded those lifeboats. But not a single man said, hey, there's a seat in that lifeboat. They stood there and they said, it's women and children. They go first. We save them. We rescue them. We have one example, and that is the director of the White Star Line says, I have to go and I have to report on this, so let me on one of the lifeboats. And he kind of, finagles his way into a lifeboat and is considered a coward for the rest of his life. Everybody has a low esteem of him for the rest of his life, but not a single other man. John Jacob Astor's on board that ship. He's one of the wealthiest men in the world. And he doesn't say, I'm one of the richest men in the world. I was in, you know, the ultra luxury first class, you know, had an apartment on board this ship with oak paneling. Certainly, I have enough money to be let on board this ship, on board this. He doesn't say that. He stands on the deck. In fact, Lady Astor says, if my husband can't get on the lifeboat, I won't either. And she holds his arm and they go down with the ship together. I mean, it's a completely different day. Almost 100 years later, you have a cruise ship founder in the Mediterranean. Costa Concordia founders in the Mediterranean and tips and starts filling with water. And men are throwing women out of the way to get to the lifeboats. A very different era, okay? Why? Because we've told men, look, you don't have to protect women. That's sexist. Well, guess what will happen? Men will exercise their strength then to just preserve themselves. So this was a day and age when men were expected to be courageous. They didn't expect the women to go out to battle for them and things like this. Men were being men. Play the man for our people and for the cities of our God. In other words, you got to be courageous in this battle. Your life is going to be in the balance. And the Lord do that which seemeth him good. Now, here's a really remarkable statement. It's the only time I'm aware of in the scripture that Joab says anything like this. Joab makes his battle plan and then he says, and we'll trust the Lord. We'll let him do what seems good here. Before this and after this, you don't find Joab saying anything about the Lord. Joab's just like, got a problem? Who do I need to kill? That's basically who Joab is. He's a problem? I got it. Just give me the word. We'll take care of him. That's how Joab operates. He's just like, if you got a problem, you just kill somebody. Solves it. All right? He's like commissioned mafia almost. There's not a whole lot godly about Joab. He's a great general. All right, you don't want a general who's afraid to wield a sword. But because he's a general, he thinks military options are the best options every time. All right, forget this negotiation. Let's just kill him. Makes it a lot easier, and we'll solve it that way. That's how he looks at things. All right, he's not a godly man. But here we have this, I think this is the influence of David, actually. That here is Joab saying, this is the plan. I'll fight the Syrians, you fight the Ammonites, we'll go to battle against each other, against them, and if we need help, we can aid one another, but we're going to leave this in the hands of the Lord. The Lord will do what he wants to do here. He has seen David trust the Lord enough times and win battles that he's been influenced by that. I'm not sure Joab how much confidence he has in the Lord, but he has some here, I think because of the good example of David. Verse 13, and Joab drew nigh, and the people that were with him unto the battle against the Syrians, and they fled before him. So what do we see here? Joab engages the Syrians and they flee. He wins. So guess what? If his brother needs help, Abishai, there's plenty of help to be had because Joab's winning. But when the children of Ammon saw that the Syrians were fled, they also before Abishai. Now the Syrians, these were mercenaries. They were professional soldiers. They're losing. So the Ammonites, who are not professional soldiers, are like, they're losing over there. That's our help. We got to run. And they start running away too. And they fled before Abishai and entered into the city. So Joab returned from the children of Ammon and came to Jerusalem. All right, so Joab says, hey, I don't need to fight this battle anymore because I've driven the Syrians off, and the Ammonites we have under siege now. And when the Syrians saw that they were smitten before Israel, they gathered themselves together. And Hadadezer sent and brought out the Syrians that were beyond the river. So they go and get reinforcements. And they came to Helam, and Shobak, the captain of the host of Hadadezer, went before them. And when it was told David, he gathered all Israel together. So he puts his army together again and passed over Jordan and came to Helam. And the Syrians set themselves in array against David and fought with him. And the Syrians fled before Israel. And David slew the men of 700 chariots of the Syrians and 40,000 horsemen and smote Shobak, the captain of their host, who died there. All right, this was, did you ever play chess? You may or may not like it. I don't know if you've ever played chess. What's the goal of chess? Capture the other side's king, right? Whoever was in charge of the other side's army, if you could kill them, you won the battle in the ancient world. This is an automatic win. They just killed the commanding general of the other side. The Israelites do, okay? He dies on the battlefield. In other words, that's why when Saul and Jonathan die, it's an automatic loss for Israel. The Philistines killed the king of Israel and the crown prince. It's a terrible day for Israel. But here, this is a day that Israel wins the battle. And when all the kings that were servants of Hadadezer saw that they were smitten before Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. So the Syrians feared to help the children of Ammon anymore. So what happens here is the Syrians go, we got beat twice. We're not helping you. Sorry. Can't pay us enough. We want to keep our territory. You're on your own. And the Lord had given. Now notice, David didn't pick this fight. He didn't even go to get revenge. David didn't say, you humiliated my men. They just assumed David's going to invade us since we humiliated his men. We better hire mercenaries. They're the ones who picked the fight, and God gives the victory to David. What we find is the proper exercise of governmental power here. David first keeps his covenant. That gets rebuffed with an insult. That leads to a war, and David exercises political power appropriately. All right? Up to this point, what do we see? David exercising appropriate political power as a king under the Lord. Now, we don't live in a theocracy like they did. In other words, God was the ultimate king of Israel, and the king was God's representative. We don't have that. The president of the United States is not, you know, the president under God is the true president. That's not how our government is set up. Now, God is the king of the universe, so the president always has to remember he has to answer to God someday. But the proper exercise of political power, the proper exercise of political power means that you recognize that God is one, ultimately here is the ultimate king of Israel, but also the one that you have to answer to. Here is the problem in our day and age, and I'll try not to get too political with this, but I have to get a little bit because we're dealing with something that has to do with the right view of the world. And that is, when you go to a statist position, and by that what I mean is the state has all the answers, you make the state God. And that kind of a government, a statist government, always opposes religion. Why? Because they fear God. They fear giving power to God. He already has it. But this is why places like communist China or North Korea oppress Christians, because they know, for a true Christian, my first loyalty is to King Jesus. All right? Now, I'm proud to be an American. I'm thankful I was born in the United States. Thankful for so many of you in here who served our nation. But I'm going to say this. I'm loyal to Jesus before I'm loyal to the United States of America. If I have to choose between them, most of the time, through most of my life, I don't have to choose between them. But if I have to choose between them, I'm going to answer to Jesus first. Okay? Jesus is my first priority. And if the United States tells me to disobey Jesus, I obey Jesus instead of them. That's the way it works. Okay? That's true of any government for a Christian. That's true of any government. If a government tells me not to preach the gospel, what did we hear in Matthew 28 this morning? I cannot obey that because the one who has all authority in heaven and earth said, go into all the world and preach the gospel. Go make disciples of all nations. I can't not do that because some human authority who has authority only under God told me not to. Okay? But here's the problem, and I want to be clear on this, and that is that I'm not talking about political parties here, but what I am talking about is a view of what government is. And that is, if you make the government the solution to everything, you've left God out of it. There are some things the government can't solve because they can't change human hearts. And there are some things that when you put a sinful human person in charge of them and give them extra power, all they do is use that power to abuse people. You know, this has happened all over the world. You know, if you lived in a developing country and you heard UN peacekeepers were coming in, you wouldn't necessarily think that was good news. If they're American soldiers or soldiers from the UK or somewhere, that might be good news. But you know how many times there have been investigations into UN peacekeeping missions? Where, you know, the UN peacekeepers were engaged in abusing the people they were supposed to protect, stealing from them and abusing them, and it wouldn't be good news. It's like, there are many countries in the world that if you get victimized, you don't call the police because they'll just victimize you a second time. Because they'll want a bribe to investigate it. So now you're going to get robbed legally by the police. You got robbed legally once, you're going to get robbed legally by the police. In other words, if the human heart is fallen and wicked and has unlimited, unrestrained power, it will do wicked things. People will do wicked things. You know, we often quote Lord Acton's famous proverb that is, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Now, that's not a true statement. The first part's true, power corrupts. Even that's not completely true. Corrupt people will abuse power is really how we should say it. But there's only one being in the whole universe with absolute power, and he's never been corrupted. So absolute power doesn't absolutely corrupt, because one God has absolute power and he's not corrupt. But if you take a corrupt human being, the more power you give them, the more corrupt they become. They just have more facility to become more corrupt. Right? So you give more power to somebody and they're going to get more corrupt with it. That's the way the fallen human heart works. So that's why our founding fathers thought it was necessary to have multiple branches of government that check each other, because they knew James Madison, who's the general architect of our Constitution, studied at the College of New Jersey. That's called Princeton University today. Okay? The College of New Jersey. Do you know who the president of the College of New Jersey was at one time? It was a man named Jonathan Edwards for a little while. I mean, these were like Samuel Davies was the president a few presidents later. Samuel Davies may not be a name that you know, but he's written some of the hymns in our hymnal. All right, these were men who believed in the biblical truth that people are sinners and that sinners will choose to sin. And so even though James Madison was not himself as devout of a Christian as those men, that was drilled into him growing up, that people are corrupt and they'll use power to gain influence and gain power and gain advantage and all kinds of things. And so what you need is you need to make sure there's other equally powerful people to keep the corruption at bay, at balance. Hold one another accountable. And so as much as we might hate the bickering that goes back and forth, you know, this is what Americans say, hey, I wish Washington would just get something done. There's actually something good about Washington bickering, and that is keeping people who are naturally sinners from just getting whatever they want. That's not bad, necessarily, always. You know, and for example, I've noticed this, like, friends of mine on social media who are anti-President Trump tend to quote, you know, go on there and go, he's out golfing again. Does he man ever work? And he does golf a lot. But guess what? I heard the same thing when President Obama was the president. He's out golfing again. Does he ever do any work? But I always kind of thought this way. Whichever president you agree with, wouldn't you be glad he's out golfing? Because he's not doing anything then. You know, if you don't agree with his politics, let him golf more. You can't get anything done. Pay him to golf. The fact is, though, I'm not trying to get too political on the parties here, but my point is that there's a certain sense in which if we invest our hope in government, I have some relatives who are very political on social media, and they'll say things like, if you're not in favor of this bill, you think that people should starve or, you know, whatever. I sit here and I go, well, have you ever thought there's another alternative? That you don't have to give the government more power always, that maybe we could feed people. I guarantee, you know, the Salvation Army and the Red Cross are more efficient at getting food to people than the federal government is. They just are. And it's just the way it is. My problem is, then, what we've done is we discount everything else. In other words, if the answer is always the only thing that can help us is government, that's exactly, if you were a corrupt leader and you wanted more power, what would you tell people? I'm the only one who can solve the problem. You have to give me this power. Right? This is why, too, I'm trying to avoid getting into the parties and all of that, but this is one of the things I think is unhealthy is that social media and 24-hour news and everything is just drumbeat politics, politics, politics. That gives them more power. If I worry every day what's going on politically, I'm giving power to people that I don't want to have power. They've got power over my daily life now. I don't want you to have power over my daily life. Leave me alone. I just want to go serve the Lord. Okay? And what happens is it actually kind of gnaws at our souls if we're always like, oh, did you hear what they did in Washington today? Well, honestly, is your life that much different now than it was 2 years ago? It is some, maybe. There's some things. I'm not saying things in Washington are unimportant, but the point is that if I'm going to serve the Lord, I want to be focused on that, not on who said what in Washington. Because that's most of what it is. He said, she said, political intrigue and drama. And some people are political junkies. They just love that stuff. If that's your hobby, that's a completely different thing. But I just think at a certain point, getting too worked up about these things brings a lack of trust in the Lord. In other words, we start to fall into their trap. That is, the government is so powerful, we can solve all your problems. No, 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 no. Only God can do those things. And what you need is to trust in the Lord. And if a government will exercise power appropriately, then a government that exercises power appropriately biblically recognizes there is a God in heaven to whom we must answer. And we're not him. So when presidents of the United States get up and say, you know, the sea levels can stop rising, I'm going to say, excuse me, you don't have that power. The president of the United States cannot control the sea levels. All right? And when the president of the United States gets up and says things like, you know, I promise peace, well, he can't do that. Promotion comes neither from the east nor the west nor the south, but God is the judge. This is what the Psalms say. He exalts one and puts down another. You can't make peace. You can't win battles. Only God can do that. God's the one who gave them into the hand of Israel in this battle. Even Joab recognizes this. It doesn't. Joab's worried. If you read this passage, Joab's worried. We got to split our army. If I'm having trouble, you come help me. But guess what? God gives them victory on both fronts because, as Joab said, the Lord do that which seemeth good. Seemeth him good. So let me plead with you, do not fall into the trap of thinking politically that somehow God is out of this, all right? There is no, Christians cannot approach political power as if God's not involved. And when I say this, I'm going to say, you know, there are scoundrels in both parties. But having said that, let's recognize the fact that those who are atheists and those who are all for unlimited political power and these kinds of things, they are cutting God out. They're cutting God out. And that's not right. All right? The reason David is a noble king here is that he doesn't cut God out. He trusts God. The reason he's an example. And the reason he's a bad example in chapter 11 is because he sends and exercises political power in a way that God would never have him do. And we'll get to that when we get to chapter 11. But it is imperative for us to recognize that God is on the throne. I'm not saying elections don't matter and that political parties, you know, that I think those impact people's lives. But let us also remember that ultimately we have to recognize there's a God in heaven. And he can use Mao Zedong. He can use Stalin. He can use Adolf Hitler. I'm not saying they're doing what he wants them to do, but he can take the wrath of man and make it praise him. He can use Donald Trump, he can use Barack Obama, he can use George W. Bush, and he can use all of that to accomplish his ends. And that ultimately we want to be people who recognize that God is the ultimate authority. And that I want, so again, when you vote, don't vote for people who are going to leave God out of things. And I'm not talking about God talk. Politicians love to talk God talk. Elections come around, everybody says God bless America, and everybody pretends to be a Christian. What I'm talking about, though, is the people who really recognize, look, we need the Lord. Not the ones who say, well, let's not bring God into this. Well, excuse me? How did you leave God out? I don't think God left the room. All right? You can't be like, well, we're not going to bring God into this. God's here. As one of our founding fathers said, right? Ben Franklin, Constitutional Convention. At the beginning of the convention, they're kind of struggling with a start, and he says, and he's a deist. He's a man who believes God made everything and kind of set it in motion. But he quotes the scripture, and he said, if the Creator notices when a sparrow falls to the ground and dies, he certainly notices what we're doing in this room. Let's implore him for wisdom. So here's a man who doesn't even believe God intervenes in human history much, and he says, let's ask for his help. Because we won't do anything here unless we ask for God's help. See, I'd rather have a man like that, even though he wasn't a born-again Christian, who at least doesn't leave God out, than a man who claims to be a born-again Christian, but then in practice leaves God out. I don't care about the God talk. What I want to know is, in practice, are you an atheist, or in practice do you recognize there's a God you have to answer to? That's what I want to know. And that is an important thing, and unfortunately those kind of people are becoming more and more, I shouldn't say they're more and more rare, but we're putting up with more and more nonsense in our leaders than we used to. And so we ought to have this right view that there is a God in heaven and that political power needs to be exercised with that in mind. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we do.